This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Newsflash. Extreme heat is bubbling up everywhere in the Northern Hemisphere and even in the South. Here are tweets for a single week, the last week of June 2023, from weather historian Maximiliano Herrera and other sources. Texas and the U.S. South, at least a dozen dead as heat dome bakes southern U.S. for weeks. Northern Canada, exceptional heat breeding unstoppable fires continues in the Canadian North. Portugal and Spain, record heat wave in the Algarve in Portugal, smashing all records, and 20 heat records broken in Spain. Austria, Herrera says, absolutely mind-blowing heat record in Austria. Just before midnight, Oberndorf rose to 36.1 degrees C, beating its monthly heat record. It is one of the highest temperatures ever recorded in Europe at midnight, and one of the very few cases a record is broken in the nighttime. Morocco, WX weatherman Scott Duncan reports, extreme heat in northwest Africa. Morocco has just observed its hottest day on record. 48.5 degrees C breaks the previous national June record by 1.6 degrees C set in 2012. Saudi Arabia. According to The Guardian, more than 2,000 people suffered heat stress during the Hajj pilgrimage, Saudi officials said on Thursday, after temperatures soared to 48 degrees C or 118 degrees Fahrenheit. Iran. Eastern Iran is also living the harshest heat wave in its history, with weeks of relentless record heat, breaking all records. Northern India, punishing relentless heat continues. China, more records in China, stifling hot and humid night at Shanghai. Several hundreds of records have been falling in China since the first day of the month, and more are coming. Australia, and it's their winter. Queensland and more hit new records high like 32 degrees C, 89 degrees Fahrenheit. Again, in winter. Japan. Extraordinary heat wave in Japan. Records fall by the dozens every day. Caribbean. Never-ending heat record in the Dominican Republic. Under heat waves for months. South America. Summer and winter in South America. There you go. A trip around the world in record-setting heat. It doesn't make the news, and nothing is being done about it. Let's get to our important guests. You always hear about climate change or maybe extinctions by the end of this century or beyond. But what if that horror comes much sooner, during your own life? What is really possible if things go from bad to worse? A shocking new peer-reviewed paper was just published in Nature Communications. The title is Earlier Collapse of Anthropocene Ecosystems, Driven by Multiple Faster and Noisier Drivers. We have reached the lead author. Simon Wilcock is Principal Research Scientist at Rothamsted Research, the oldest agricultural research institute in the world. He is also Professor of Sustainability at Bangor University in Wales. From the UK, Simon Wilcock, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much. And just so you know, it's published in Nature Sustainability. That's a different journal.
Ah, Nature Sustainability. Thank you very much for that. Simon, this paper coming out just now, well, it ruined my vacation. I was going to take some time off, but this is too important. It is exactly what many of our listeners feared. You really think the climate could be more threatening much sooner than we have been led to believe?
So what we looked at was how effectively the climate and other pressures might then affect ecosystems. So there's quite a lot of work on tipping points and regime shifts to do with the climate and the atmospheric system, but we focused more on terrestrial systems and so stuff that people are degrading. And we basically looked at whether multiple pressures, so for example, adding climate change on top of the pressure of deforestation, on top of the pressure of hunting, and then throwing in a few extreme events, all of which happen in the real world and becoming more intense and more frequent, how that would affect ecosystem collapse. And it brought them worryingly closer to the present day.
Well, maybe we should take a look at one of the case studies in your paper, and you've kind of alluded to it already. Could you talk about the factors that could bring rapid decline in the great Amazon rainforest?
So the Amazon, is quite well known for being under pretty horrendous pressure. So it's being deforested at quite high rates. The parts that aren't being deforested, many of those parts are being degraded. So, you know, not completely cut down, but damaged in some way. Then it's experiencing quite a lot of extreme temperatures or droughts. And whenever there's a drought now in the Amazon rainforest turns from a carbon sink, so it turns from absorbing carbon to emitting carbon. And other pressures include hunting, mining, and then there's the extreme events. So, like, we're currently in an El Nino year, so we're expecting, you know, quite severe weather in the Amazon this year. These all add up to put the Amazon under a lot of pressure. And there was a paper last year that came out that showed that the resilience of the Amazon forest is declining. And basically, that's a warning sign. Like, if the Amazon is becoming less resilient, and then it's less able to cope with these stresses. And then combine that with our paper that shows when there are multiple stresses, the collapses happen sooner. That's when things start to get really worrying.
You also studied the second largest lake in India, although it's called the Chilika, I believe that's how it's pronounced, the Chilika Lagoon. In the West, few people have heard about it. It sounds like an odd choice for a study. Why there?
Primarily because one of my co-authors, Greg Cooper, he did his PhD focused on that lake. So many of the models that we use to look at tipping points and ecosystem collapse, many of those models are actually quite simple. Whereas the model that Greg built in his PhD that looked at that lake, it was really very complicated. It had lots of interactions between the fisher people around that lake and also the ecosystem in that lake and the sea washing into the lagoon. It's a very, very complex model. So by focusing on that model, we could effectively check that the simpler models that we also included in the paper were giving us similar answers. And if we got similar answers from the more simple models and the more complex models, then that implies that potentially we're onto something and we start to then believe the result.
In March 2021, I interviewed a young climate scientist, Johannes Lohmann, he was a postdoc at Denmark's Niels Bohr Institute at the time. And Johannes studied past glacial abrupt climate changes. He warned Earth could hit tipping points much sooner than expected, partly due to the rate of climate change. What are some of the problems with the speed that climate change is developing?
Essentially, when things happen, so we looked at two things in our system. We looked at rate and noise and cumulative stress. So what we found in our paper is there's a couple of ways to trigger a collapse, one of which is just sheer pressure, cumulative stress, the equivalent of the straw that broke the camel's back. The other of which is rate. So effectively swamping the system just by the change is just too quick for the system to keep up, for it to buffer itself. And that is, well, the opposite of having a frog in boiling water, right? A frog in boiling water slowly gets used to it. And just like you, when you step into a bath, if you stayed in the bath and slowly heated it up, you'd probably be all right. But if it's slightly hot and you just sort of jump in, you feel that it's really, really hot and you have to jump out straight away. And that's essentially because the change in temperature was too quick for you. And ecosystems are just the same.
But in fact, your team and like-minded colleagues have abandoned the term tipping point. Why, and what should we be talking about?
We avoided the phrase, in the paper, because it's to prove a tipping point, it gets quite mathematical. You have to prove what's called this hysteresis loop. That effectively means that in one direction, it takes a different amount of energy, effort, to move the system in one direction to another. A good example of something with a hysteresis loop is the rubber band, right? Very simple rubber band. To move it in one direction, you've got to stretch it out. That takes quite a lot of effort, depending on how big the rubber band is. But then when you let it go, it takes absolutely no effort to watch it snap back. Like, it does that by itself. And in this paper, we didn't run the models in both directions. So we didn't, like, prove that hysteresis. But we picked models that effectively had hysteresis shown in them previously. So these models are showing tipping points, but all the catastrophic collapses that we picked up were not necessarily part of tipping point cycles. Essentially, they were just very extreme collapses. So we focused on the language around threshold-dependent changes. So we crossed this threshold, and then there was an extreme collapse in the ecosystem. But essentially, the two often go hand in hand.
But, Simon, could Earth have as yet unknown systems acting like built-in brakes, a reaction that might slow down the rate of warming and eco-decline warned about in this new science?
Yes, there could be, like balancing feedback loops that we don't know about and that potentially weren't in the models. So that's always possible. And, you know, it's not all bad news. Like, tipping points don't all have to be bad. You could argue that the spread of mobile phones across the world, that's quite a positive tipping point. And like I said, that it does have some kind of a hysteresis loop. Like everyone goes out and buys a smartphone, and then it's very, very difficult to then take all those smartphones away from people because they've got used to them in their daily lives. Tipping points don't have to be bad. And if we seek to understand them, that maybe we can start to pull the right levers and push the right buttons to use tipping points to recover ecosystems. So potentially, you know, we can have unexpectedly quick recovery if we understand how to trigger positive tipping points rather than the ones that make the news now are effectively the negative tipping points. And they're the ones we have more information on because of the stress that we're putting our ecosystems under.
When trying to figure out how quickly ecological catastrophe could arrive, a second essential concept is sort of convergence and the interaction of a wide range of drivers. And in the paper, you break these up into primary drivers, secondary drivers, and noise. Let's start with primary versus secondary drivers. What is the difference, and can you give us some examples?
Yeah, so essentially, that's almost an artifact of the way the models were built and designed. So earlier I said most studies looking into tipping points, a lot of them use quite simple models. And so that's because it's easier for us to understand what's going on in a system if we simplify it. So the simplest system you can sort of simplify it down to is there's one stress and it's causing damage to a system, an ecosystem. It's making the ecosystem lose resilience, and then we see what happens, and that may be a tipping point. And so a lot of the models were built in that way. So they're like thinking, I want to understand the stress of, for example, increased population on the fish population in a lake in India, for example. But whilst that's useful for helping us understand that particular stress, it doesn't reflect the real world in the same way. Because that just doesn't happen. That stress in that isolated way just doesn't tend to happen in the real world. There's always another stress as well, or occasionally something else happens. And so that's where these secondary and tertiary stresses come into it. So effectively, there were other variables in the model that we could alter. But maybe the model wasn't designed when it was originally built with those variables being altered in mind, but they could be altered in a way to replicate a stress on a slightly different part of the system, so the actions of a different stress. And so by doing that, we were able to basically better simulate the stresses that are happening in the real world, which are complex and, you know, there's many at a time. And hopefully that then makes the output from the model a bit more representative of what is happening in the real world, even if the results are a little bit worrying.
The third type of driver this paper calls noise. What do you mean?
So, again, to simplify things down, when you want to picture the simplest system, you don't have any noise in there. So you just put in a real simple ramping up of a stress. Your stress, say, would go from 1 to 10, and you would just slowly, you know, go 1, 2, 3, 4, sequentially all the way to 10. But again, that's not what happens. So if we look at, for example, temperature change across the globe, you know, sometimes it goes up quite a lot, and then it goes down a little bit. So there's there's a little bit of noise in that overall increasing temperature system. And so what we did was essentially we inserted that back in to our stress to, again, make it more realistic. And this is the equivalent of extreme events. So, for example, if I go back to the temperature example, occasionally you get heat waves. don't you? And that would be noise pushing it up, the temperature unexpectedly up a little bit. And then it might go down on the next time step, so in the next month or something like that. And so that's why we added noise into the model, to sort of capture the impacts of that.
Well, after 3 years of La Nina in the Pacific, we're now confident that we're entering an El Nino in coming months. Those are natural oscillations in the ocean states. They can modify the climate. Does that qualify as noise?
Yeah, yeah. Because essentially, they cause extreme events. It does tend to make, for example, the Amazon will be drier and hotter this year than it would have been in the La Nina years. First, essentially, that will provide an extreme value in the overall trend of increasing temperature. So that's exactly the kind of effect that we were trying to capture by putting noise into our signals.
Well, you found that every case you modeled has the capacity to speed up, but they did not all act the same or react equally to the same forces?
No, yes. Yeah. So we found that some systems were brought close to the present day by addition of another driver. So we had a primary driver, and if you added a secondary driver, that had a large effect, whereas other models showed that noise had a bigger effect. And all models, though, did show that the combination of multiple drivers and noise was generally the worst-case scenario, which is worrying because that's probably the most similar scenario to the present day.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with research scientist Simon Wilcock. New science warns of nasty surprises, and perhaps ecosystem collapse could come sooner. And just the fact that we're not expecting extremes and breakdowns, we're not planning for them, isn't that another huge problem, Simon?
That is a big problem. They're really hard to plan for, though, because effectively what we're talking about is low likelihood but high impact events. And there's a lot of uncertainty involved. So whilst we may think that a tipping point might happen in the Amazon, for example, it doesn't mean it will happen. If it just happens gradually or if it doesn't happen, then the differences are so extreme that it's really, really hard to plan for. One thing we can do, though, is essentially detect these things in advance better if we improve our monitoring. So if we monitor several stresses rather than just the easy-to-measure ones, if we just monitor the easy-to-measure ones, that's the equivalent of just looking at the primary driver, which we know would be a bad idea, because if the paper shows that if you only focus on the primary driver, then effectively these ecosystem collapses will happen unexpectedly, and that's because the stress of the secondary and tertiary drivers that you weren't looking at creeped up, and they cause the system to collapse. But by better monitoring, say, all three drivers in a system with three drivers, you'll see it coming better. You'll see this tipping point coming. You'll be able to react and be like, hang on, we're putting the ecosystem under too much stress here. We've picked up these warning signs, like the loss of resilience in the Amazon forest that I mentioned earlier. We've picked up on these warning signs, and then we've done something about it. So I think it's that kind of adaptive management that we need, and it has to be driven by better monitoring.
Well, here's a quick quote from the new paper in the journal Nature Sustainability. Overall, global warming will increase the frequency of unprecedented extreme events, raise the probability of compound events, and ultimately could combine to make multiple system failures more likely. So what is the role of what you call erratic events in accelerating the impacts of climate change?
So essentially that's the noise we were talking about earlier. What seems to happen is that although the noise we had in our model could move the system towards a tipping point, it can make a stress worse, but it could also move the system away from that critical threshold. It could make the stress, you know, less bad. But because there's such a cliff edge at that threshold that causes the tipping point, on average, the effect of the noise, these extreme events, just is bad. Because if you reduce the temperature by 1 degree, that makes the system a little bit safer. But if you increase by 1 degree, that effectively plummets you off a cliff. So the average change was always quite extreme by adding noise.
Reading this free open access paper, I learned almost as much about what we don't know as what we do. What strikes you as key unknowns?
Yeah, there is quite a lot of unknowns here. So tipping points and these kind of abrupt changes, they're often most studied in what I would call a fluid system. So we have quite a lot of scientific studies looking at threshold-dependent changes in the atmosphere. So, for example, temperature, carbon, and also in lakes. There's quite a lot of evidence from lakes going from clear to like an algae-filled state. But terrestrial ecosystems might behave a little differently. They might not be quite as connected because they're not as fluid. So actually, the collapses might not spread throughout the ecosystem in the same way. And also, I think we've only just really begun to grapple with how we can use the same kind of systems dynamics, the same kind of theories, in a positive way. So I think it's really in its infancy where we're beginning to understand, how can we pull the levers to cause a positive tipping point and an unexpected recovery. And when we have that, when we start to understand that, we can really start to harness what is essentially a bad news story in a really good, positive way.
Well, one of the qualities I love about good science is when authors are not afraid to raise limitations like that or even objections to their own work. What other cautions and disclaimers did your team add in?
Well, I think one of the main ones is these are models, right? Models don't always reflect reality. And so we need a lot more empirical data of real systems. But the bad news is, to get that empirical data of systems collapsing under stress of multiple drivers, effectively we need to collapse systems. And we can either wait for that to happen naturally, like in Lake Erhai, which is we mentioned in our paper, and that was one of the data sets that gives us encouragement that our models are showing the same thing, the right thing. Or we can do that experimentally. So currently I'm working on a project where we're building basically plots to put them under future climate extremes so that we can then watch to see what happens. So if they do critically fail, we can see whether that was under, say, just a temperature increase that we put them under, or did they go through that failure sooner if we put them under a temperature increase and flooded them, for example. So those kind of experiments is what we need, and that's what a lot of my collaborators and I are now moving on to, both in like glass houses, in greenhouses, but also in the field as well.
On June 22nd, along with co-authors John Deering and Gregory Cooper, you published an explainer for the public. And among other things, you caution ecological disaster cannot be fixed by governments like the bailouts of Western banks in 2008. Why not?
Well, essentially, because we don't have the same stock in the back of our pocket. If you want to bail out a bank, effectively, you print a bit more money, don't you? If we want to bail out of an ecosystem, we can't suddenly print more species. That's not how it works. So essentially, nature has to bail itself out, and that doesn't obey our rules. If we can't, as of yet, push a button and cause an ecosystem to suddenly be like, oh yeah, okay, I'm going to start recovering. Essentially, some of the research that I talked about earlier, where we can potentially harness the systems dynamics theory to increase rates of recovery, essentially that might give us a bit more of that power, but it's not something we can do today.
There was decent media coverage for this paper. The phrase ecological doom loops generated over 35,000 hits on Google within 4 days. It'll probably carry on as a meme, but I'm still pretty sure of two things. Most of the public won't know about this, and UK residents will keep flying to Spain in winter, even if the Spanish climate becomes like the Sahara. Where is the space for this new risk awareness to really take root?
I think in adaptive management. I think essentially what this experience shows is that if we monitor things, and if we monitor as many stresses as we can monitor, even if some of those stresses are quite hard to monitor, so potentially quite expensive, it is worth it. Because it's a better way of then forecasting whether the system we're interested in is basically going towards the point where it's going to be in trouble. And then we can avoid it. We can take action to start to change people's behavior, you know, maybe convince them to take the train to Spain instead. But we can only do that once we've given a red light. We've basically said, look, this is a danger sign. We really need to change behavior now. And enhanced monitoring of multiple stresses will really help us give that warning.
I was kind of surprised to find that you work with an agricultural research institute. You're a professor in sustainability. Is it a leap from that to the collision of climate change and the whole living world, as in this big paper?
I don't think so at all. So I sort of think of myself as a systems scientist. So I study multiple systems, and I often focus most on socio-ecological systems, so systems that have a bit of nature going on, but also some impacts of people. And that describes agriculture perfectly. You know, essentially, agriculture is us harnessing nature to grow food. And there's obviously a large human influence because you've got a lot of actions on behalf of the farmer and all the other farm workers. And essentially, many other ecosystems are also just socio-ecological systems. So, for example, if we consider a national park, we might have lots of ecology, lots of nature going on in that natural park, but you've also got pressure from people maybe going to visit the national park. And that kind of socio-ecological system, maybe the social part of it is smaller than the ecological part, but it's still a socio-ecological system, so it's still sort of within my area of expertise.
In conclusion, how much sooner did you find that big system breakdowns could happen?
We found that essentially there was a bit of a range, but if we have additional stresses and or noise, so more extreme events, we found that the collapses occurred about between roughly 38 to 81% closer to today than they would have if we just had one stress on the system, which is quite substantial.
Are you worried about it?
Yes. Yeah, I am. I'm worried when you combine effectively the results of this paper with a couple of other papers, and we sort of hinted about the Amazon quite a lot in this conversation. So essentially, what the paper that we've recently published shows is that there is a real risk with multiple drivers and extreme events of the Amazon any system, but the Amazon moving from a rainforest-like state to a savanna-like state. And if you couple that with, you know, a finding from last year that the Amazon is losing resilience, then maybe that starts to suggest that when we're talking about moving it towards the present day, maybe we're actually talking, oh, it's quite close to the present day. And then you couple it with a paper that we published in 2020 in Nature Communications that showed that once the Amazon does cross the threshold, it would only take, I think it was about 49 years to actually collapse. So if the collapse is happening soon, let's say 2030 or starting then, potentially it would then be over. It would be a savanna by 2080. And to be honest, that frightens me to be the last, in the last generation, amongst the last people that see the Amazon rainforest as a rainforest and not as a massive savanna, is really, really worrying, because obviously when it switches to a savanna, that could start a huge domino effect, because that will release a lot of carbon, that will increase global temperatures. If that increases global temperatures enough, then you have ice sheets melting, for example, which then maybe increases sea level rise, and that then would impact a whole world, basically, ecosystems, people, cities, and that's basically a domino effect that I would rather not start.
We have been speaking with Principal Scientist Simon Wilcock from Rothamsted Research and Bangor University in Wales. You can and should read this worrying new paper called Earlier Collapse of Anthropocene Ecosystems, Driven by Multiple Faster and Noisier Drivers, as published in Nature Sustainability. Find links to that and more about this paper in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Simon, thank you so much for giving your valuable time with us.